Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week, we bring you the final episode of the Delaware Humanities podcast, People and Planet. The podcast explores how Delawareans connect to the environments and cultures around them, and the cultural practices and creative works that bring us closer to the planet we call home. On this final episode, we feature a more grounded personal look at the impact of connecting to nature and culture. The natural world and cultural identity have played a substantial role in writer and nature photographer Leslie Sue Oh's professional and personal journey. Her work has taken her around the country and the world to experience the vast array of what the planet and its cultures have to offer. And the memoir she's working on, Fireweed, weaves together themes of family, cultural identity, and the natural world to tell her very personal story of self-discovery and healing after experiencing profound loss. Your connection to nature and the natural world started young. I saw one quote from you where you said you feel like you grew up in the national parks of the United States and Canada. Can you give us a sense of what those formative years were like and how they created a foundation for your life and career?
Sure. So I was raised by a very exciting, adventurous mother who thought it was more important to play with her kids. She fell in love with national parks in 1967 when she was on a honeymoon with my dad. And they were in Shenandoah National Park. And she was like, I want to see all the national parks in the United States and Canada. And so when my brother and I were born, she started taking us to national parks. That was like our thing. And what was cool, she was a photographer. So every national park we went to, I felt like I always had the weight of a camera around my neck because she would have one and I would have, and she would be teaching me like how to compose photos. And she was always asking me like, what story are you trying to tell? So for example, one of my favorite photos of hers is one where my brother and I are walking or wading through a field of beach grass in Channel Islands National Park. And both of us are not paying any attention to her. Didn't even know she was studying us through her lens. And my hair is hanging across my face. You can't see if my eyes are open or shut, but it's such a classic photo of hers because it captures us listening. We're silent and we're listening to the sounds of maybe like, you know, the grass waving in the wind and that kind of stuff. So I feel very lucky that she raised me that way, where we were in the present moment a lot. And that's a lesson that I would forget and not remember until years later when a very famous traditional healer in Alaska, who unfortunately passed away, Auntie Rita, used to try to teach me these lessons when she took me out foraging for different plants. And she would remind me that children are very good at staying in the present moment. And I think that's what national parks did for us.
And I guess you could see that almost direct through line from that experience when you were young to what you ultimately wound up doing as a career.
Yes, except my birth mom and dad are, you know, Chinese. I was born in North Carolina. So they did not want me to be a writer. They wanted me to be a doctor. So I sort of like, I would say it was because my mother and brother died of the same disease very shortly before I turned 21. That changed everything. Because at that point in time, I was set to be a doctor. Meanwhile, I had all these journals that I had written in national parks, like through my childhood, but that's not what I was being groomed for. So backing up a little bit, I guess I was a freshman in college. My brother was 17. He wakes up with extreme pain in his side, and we discover it's liver cancer caused by hepatitis B. And then I lose him the following year at 18. And a week after he died, my mother was diagnosed with the same disease. So I think if my mother didn't die, I think I might have still tried to pursue medicine. But after she died too, I lost both of them. I was like, well, I don't believe in medicine anymore. I believe in prevention. And so that's when I got a degree in public health to satisfy my dad, who still wants me to be a doctor. The fire, so fireweed. My memoir is called Fireweed.
I was going to say, I mean,
So, yeah.
you detail this journey you're talking about, coping with that loss of your brother and your mother in that memoir, Fireweed. What prompted you to write such a deeply personal memoir about that?
Honestly, that's kind of how I healed from the deaths, and it's still a work in progress, but now it evolved and grown to cover almost 20 years from after my mother and brother died until I became like a mother of four. So ultimately what happens is my mother's dying request was for my dad to take me to Alaska, finish all the national parks we didn't do, finish together. So at that point in time when they died, we had seen nearly all the national parks in the US and Canada. I think my mother understood that my healing would depend on the natural world, and the indigenous people most intimate to these places. But my father grieved in a very traditional Chinese way. He sold our house, got remarried, had another son, pretended that everything was fine, nothing bad had happened. And my relatives expected me to do the same thing. So instead, I ran off to Glacier National Park. And so that's kind of where the memoir starts. But what I realized over time is like keep going back to this image of fireweed, because when you ask me about that time in my life, like what I imagine is the only way I feel like I can cope with that time in my life is to imagine my emotional and mental landscape is like the blast zone after Mount St. Helens erupted. It's basically the largest, most powerful natural disaster in US history. It flattened and scorched 500-year-old firs, flattened cedar, and killed all the fish and salamanders. And that's how I felt. And the ecologists and geologists theorized that it would take centuries for life to return. But they went back a week after the eruption and were surprised to discover a little tiny green shoot, which ended up being fireweed. And so I have been collecting fireweed all throughout my childhood, not knowing that this is a plant that colonizes burnt and devastated landscapes. So the story, the memoir, is about how I eventually find things that symbolize fireweed in my life, but maybe I don't recognize that. And among that is like my husband and my kids, because I swore I would never have children or get married without her. And also, fireweed to me is the mothers that adopted me shortly after my mother died. And I want to acknowledge these mothers because these are the mothers who shaped my connection with our planet. So I mentioned my birth mother and her way of introducing me to the natural world, but it was Ursula Noke Wilson, a Navajo midwife who I met at a conference like a couple years after my mom died. And I went up to her after the conference because I knew I just felt like I had to speak to her. And before I even said anything, she grabbed my hand and said, "Our paths were meant to cross." And she adopted me a few years later, adopted my husband as well at our wedding, and gave me a Navajo name that means journey with caring and journey to bring out gifts. And I feel like that's what guides my artistic intention. It's being a storyteller and a photographer that serves a people or place.
You mentioned this piece of your journey with dealing with your own Chinese heritage and then kind of moving some of these indigenous culture and traditions into your life. And how important was kind of reconciling all those things to helping you find the path you wound up on?
It was hard because obviously I didn't want to culturally appropriate or, I think I always try to make sure I acknowledge who it is that taught me these things. So Ursula, Earth was an important lesson to my kids too. She would teach them how to make fry bread, and she would explain to them that the mountains are mothers, you know, the everything in the natural world is our relative. And she would teach the kids how to, you know, if you're gonna go climb on a mountain, and they're all snowboard cross competitors. So she's like, before you go snowboard, thank this mountain before you recreate on it, you know, and give it a blessing. So these are all things that I was taught, and I shared it with my children, of course, but didn't know if I could share that in my writing. And I was encouraged by my mom. She likes me to call her my res mom. That I am hers, you know, that's what she always said. And so that I like these were things that my readers didn't know about, that they appreciated it when I shared that kind of information. And before I get too far, I want to also thank Elaine Abraham, who in 2016 she passed away. That was when my youngest was born. And she and I had met like 10 or 20 years before that, when I was working in Alaska and for the Alaska Native Science Commission. And she's the last matriarch of the Tlingit Raven Moiety Copper River Clan Owl House. And she invited me to Yakutat to cover her story about a potlatch, which I was felt very honored that she trusted me to write about it. And, you know, the whole potlatch thing is thrown after someone passes away, and it's all about the whole community coming together and helping you to grieve in a sense, but also to give gifts to everybody at the end, so that there's a balance of like, okay, sadness and happiness. And so the memoir ends with Elaine passing away, and at her potlatch, she asks her children to adopt our family. So, what for me, I felt my losing my mother and my brother, and also my dad, was like losing my anchor. And when a lot of us are in the diasporic, you know, families, we're not anchored to land. And I was on the search, like after my mom died, to connect to a place and a landscape that would be permanent enough that if something should happen to me, my kids, you know, will have a place to go to that they know is home and where we are, we're rooted. But Elaine and her family are continuing to be a very important part of my life and my children's. And what I'm seeing now that my kids are 20, 17, 12 and 9. The older two, they founded a fly fishing club at their high school, because they felt that where we live in Lake Tahoe, watersheds is it doesn't behave like other watersheds. Most watersheds drain into the ocean, but where we live here in the Truckee River watershed, the water begins with Lake Tahoe, drains into Truckee River, but terminates at Pyramid Lake. My kids wanted to bring fly fishing out to the kids out in Pyramid Lake, and also educate their peers about how everything we do up here impacts the Pyramid Lake Paiute Reservation. And so for the last 4 years, they've been distributing fly fishing rods to the indigenous youth out there. And I mean, it's just a start, but there's fly fishing buddies that the high school kids here in Lake Tahoe make with the Pyramid Lake kids. And now they're calling each other and going fishing together. Really nice to see that's happening.
I was going to say, your family obviously is a big part of your story, and as you've noted, kind of continuing now with your children. And in our last episode, we were talking with a local zoo and natural history museum about their efforts to engage family and kids and kind of make those connections in young people with the natural world around them. What's your advice to families about finding those connections to nature and the environment and the impact it can have, as you kind of just noted with your kids and the fly fishing program?
I write a lot about how I introduced these concepts to my kids. So a lot of the things I write about shows other families how to introduce like insurance to your children at a young age. And like, don't be afraid to ask different tour operators, like if they have a minimum age requirement. Sometimes they'll work with you to figure out a way to make it work. For example, when we went to Wrangell St. Elias, my son was only two. He just learned how to walk, but we wanted to hike a glacier. And he was too young, and but we wanted him to be part of experience. And so the tour operator found adult instep crampons. They usually fit in the middle of an adult person's foot, but they were able to fit that on his little feet. And I remember the two, at that time, 5 and 2 years old, running up the glacier. I hadn't finished putting on my crampons, and I'm just like, oh my gosh, I hope they don't trip or kick each other. But they didn't. They were fine. One of my mentors told me, like, think about when you put kids out and they go outside and it's raining. He said, don't tell them to put on a jacket. The way he explained to me is that you're conditioning the child to believe that rain is bad. And so all my kids are in Boy Scouts. Sometimes we go camping, and when it rains, everybody disappears. And we're like, why did everyone leave? And so my kids are like, why are people scared when the weather is bad? Or, and I think it's because we are often placed in situations where adventures do go wrong. And honestly, we just say, okay, what do we do about it? So they're really great problem solvers. And I appreciate traveling with them now because they just like when something goes wrong, and if I like freak out about something, they're like, that's okay. We'll do something else, you know? Like they can pivot really easily, which I appreciate. And I'm encouraged by my friends to share kind of how I do that. Like, how do I place children in adventures where it's slightly out of their comfort zone, but you know, not too much to ask them to just face their fear. And when they overcome that fear, I see them as being very resilient children. And so I hope to share all that information.
So I'm curious. I mean, obviously, you've traveled extensively, and your writing and photography have covered a tremendous amount of ground. Are there certain things you're looking for when deciding what to focus on, what stories you want to tell?
Yeah, so for me, the story will sometimes chase me. I'll give you an example. I was invited by the Adventure Travel Trade Association on a trip to Brazil. We basically went on a different adventures that they planned for us, and then we would give them our opinion of how this adventure might work when they open up these opportunities for other people. And so there's a cave in Brazil that's called the Devil's Cave. It's the longest cave in the world. And I thought I was going to write about that. What ended up happening on that trip was we rappelled down this 100-foot cliff, and I took out my iPhone, snapped a picture of my friend Josiah coming down, and he's our videographer on this trip. And so I felt, oh, I should get a good picture of him. And I just snapped it and looked at it, and I knew I had a winner. But 2 hours later, after we were swimming through this cave, and very interesting cave, by the way, because you have to pull yourself through. Some of the areas are so deep that you have to pull yourself with a rope, like through these tunnels and things like that. And then at the end, there's a huge waterfall that's very strong, and we all wanted to get a picture under it. When I stepped under that waterfall, my phone, which was inside of a Sea to Summit like waterproof bag, it slipped out of my pocket. We all tried to look for it, couldn't find it. It was very murky waters, and then I followed the guide underneath the waterfall because that's where he was going, and didn't realize it was a very long swim. And so I tried to come up for air, and I couldn't find my way to the other cave, and so he pulled me out by my hair, and I was just like, okay, we're done. I don't care about the phone anymore, but it's probably going to be found years from now. But it's that picture. I really want that picture. So 2 days later, One of the guys, they found me. They surprised me with my phone.
Wow.
So this story, I'm telling it terribly. So I should probably direct you to reading it because it's ultimately about the kindness of the people in Brazil, right? Who would go back into that cave, which took almost, I would say, several hours to get to that point. And then he dived for my phone with a pair of goggles, and he found it churning at the bottom of this waterfall because it was so strong. It created like this like ditch that it was stuck in. The bag wasn't even sealed. The phone was still on. By the time I got it, of course, it died. But when I turned it on after putting it on rice for a day, it was still posting something that I was trying to do on Facebook before I walked into the cave. And the photo, of course, got published in Alpinist magazine along with a story. And so you should check out that story. It's called Lost and Found. And ultimately, the lesson there being, the extent that some stranger would go out of their way to like, it's like I wanted to take a picture of my friend and they wanted to retrieve something that was very difficult to get. So,
That is a great story. I do want to mention you did spend some time living here in Delaware, and in 2019 won a Delaware Division of the Arts Individual Fellowship for an established professional in literature. And I'm curious, how did your time in Delaware contribute to your journey? And is there anything about the First States landscape and environment that you connected with?
yes. So I moved to Delaware in 2015 when my kids were 10, 7, and 2, and the youngest one wasn't even born yet. And it was about the time I had been teaching up until that point, creative writing. And I always wanted to be a travel writer, but my parents always, they were very negative about me pursuing a writing career. I also thought becoming a travel writer was impossible when you're a mother of three. Of course, now I'm a mother of four. And that was when I started pitching to Washington Post. I started writing for Outside around then that time as well. And Condé Nast Traveler, Travel and Leisure, like that's kind of the years that where I first started. And I think what I loved about Delaware was the community. There was a writers group actually founded by Jen Epler and Mark Warman. And it was inspired by actually the Wilmington Writers Conference in June 2017 at the Delaware Art Museum. So they formed a writers group and invited me to be part of that. And so they're definitely going to be mentioned in my acknowledgments for my memoir because they all critiqued parts of it. And there were so many, like we would just rent a cabin somewhere in one of the state parks and spend a whole weekend writing together. And those things, it hasn't happened for me out here where I am now, but I miss that. Yeah, many thanks to Delaware for also supporting me at a time when I had young children, because I really helped me to be able to make progress on my memoir.
Since this is the season finale of the podcast, you get the final word. So I wanted to ask,
Oh,
when you think about what people can learn from their planet, what do you feel they should try to focus on?
wow. Well, I like the advice of every guest that you've brought on have provided very simple, practical tips. The one that sticks out to me is that I already have wrote down, and we're going to make that change in our family, is to install yellow light bulbs outside of our house instead of the white ones so that the bugs aren't attracted to it. There are other, I love those kind of simple, I think, incremental changes that we can make. My kids are really into, they're worried about those coffee pods that we drink. I think they've gotten better. There are pods now that are safer, but usually you have to take them apart and then dump the grounds out separately and recycle just like the cup part. Well, for years we have tried to do this in our household, and I'm very embarrassed that we still don't have a good system. Like oftentimes we collect it all in a bag, and then by the time we get to it, it's all mildewed. So be, I say be kind to yourself and just try something. If it doesn't work for your family, find something else simple that you can do that will take care of, that will help the planet. Whether it's taking shorter showers, turning off lights, or I share a lot about what Auntie Rita Blumenstein instructed about harvesting. Like when you're out, don't take all of the plants that you're collecting, leave some for the animals, right? And then maybe just understanding that these natural resources are relatives instead of a resource, maybe that's a start.
You've been listening to a portion of the Delaware Humanities podcast, People and Planet, with writer and nature photographer Leslie Sue Oh. The full podcast is available at DelawarePublic.org and DEHumanities.org. People and Planet is brought to you by Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. And that'll do it for this edition of The Green. The stories, interviews, and podcasts you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, the staff at Delaware Humanities and Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny. For them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.